I've been asked to make it quite clear where this cinema was in Road High Street. Now, originally, there was a big between number 40 and number 36, where Cecil Bottomley lives. There was a big stone, two-story stone-built building which came right out into the high street on a line with these cottages which I previously mentioned. And this made the high street, of course, very, very narrow. But I always understood, I demolished that building and built a garage behind where it stood. But I always understood that the upper floor was made into a cinema, and rather like the old magic lantern style stuff, and that films were shown in there before a good many of the picture houses were operating in Northampton. The ground floor, when I first knew it, had been converted to a domestic garage and general store. But it was a very substantial stone-built building with a slated roof. And then I understand that when the cinema finally closed, and I have no dates for this, a very enterprising chap from Hartwell bought all the seats and put them in lorries and made a bus service to Hartwell and all around Hartwell. So I thought that was very enterprising. Now, to go back to myself and my business, my wife and my business and that, I started as a builder in May 1960. And my first priority was to convert the four of these cottages at New Dustin into two houses. They were very, very good-looking buildings, very well built at the front, and very nice stonework at the front, but at the back, it was all brickwork, and what is known in the building trade as a Queen Anne front and a Mary Anne behind. There were only 4.5-inch walls dividing the properties, so when I'd made them into two separate dwellings, I had to increase the thickness of the wall between the properties to make them comply with modern standards. And I did everything myself. It was a very interesting project, really. I say I did everything myself, but on the first pair of cottages, I had to put in some pretty big RSJs. Well, they were only 7x4 in section, but they were some 13 feet long, and they were heavy section RSJs. So they were quite heavy and took a bit of handling. And so I was very worried as to how I was going to handle these things on my own. However, by this time, I'd worked for a little while on these cottages. And by this time, people were bringing me bowls of soup and that at dinner time. And so, as I say, I was enjoying myself. And then one of the local women, she was an Austrian girl, and very strong, very powerful woman. And she said, she saw the RSJs, and she said, how was I going to put them up? And I said, well, that's something that's bothering me. I want to get it done during the week, I said, my wife usually helps me with things, but I said, she won't be available this week. So, well, she said, I could give you a hand. And as I say, she was a very powerful woman. And the two of us put these RSJs up and I built them in. I was very surprised, but not anymore after the way she handled them. I converted two houses and made them into one. And of course, all this time I was laying out money and I was not getting any money in. I had a couple who were interested in the property, and I decided to sell this first house for the same price as a Chowne's bungalow, because they weren't the, in my opinion, I unfortunately knew the construction of the building, and they were a bit jerry-built apart from this wonderful frontage. However, this chap and his partner, which was another novelty for me in those days, those folks were married, but they were just partners, and they were very keen on this place, and eventually they bought it. And I then had money to do the other pair, not the other pair. And also by this time, something which I didn't want to happen, but did happen, the local people, obviously they knew, I knew Dustin, they knew I was a builder. With all the tales that had been told about me, a decent builder, you see. And so local people came and asked me to do little jobs for them. Now, I didn't really want to do these jobs because, of course, it was all time taken out of me getting my main project done. But I realized that I'd get ready cash along the way, which was invaluable, especially to my wife. And who seemed to be able to manage on thin air, really. So I had some very interesting jobs, and I did one job for this Austrian lady. I remember I only charged her, I would say, a nominal sum because she used to help me. But I put a new floor in her living room, The joists were so worm-eaten that the joists had to be replaced. And I also put a light girder across to steady them because the span was too great, really. I said to her, when we stripped the old floor out, it was absolutely alive with woodworm. And I said, on the one side, I said, there were terrace houses, you see. And so obviously the door, the front door and the back door were in line. And I said, three of the joists up that end are totally different. They've been put in at a later stage. Because they're not, the two of them, I said, are not even worm-eaten. Oh no, she said, well, that was when they dropped the pig. So I said, oh, what? Well, she said, we used to keep pigs. And we used to have one for the house and one or two to sell on bacon fees. And she said, these chaps came with a lorry, and she said they weren't really very good at handling pigs. So the one chap said, she said, we used to put a cord on the pig's leg and just lead it through the house and then put it in the lorry. And this chap said, oh, no, I couldn't mess about like that. He said, we'll carry it out. So So, of course, they eventually caught the pig, and by this time it was covered in muck. And the one fellow grabbed its ears, and he got hold of the front end of it, and the other was carrying the rear flanks. And they dropped this pig, and it went clean through the floor and into the coal cellar. And the china cabinet was balanced there very precariously, and it did break a bit of china, but anyway, they salvaged that first and then decided to go down the cellar and deal with the pig. Well, of course, they couldn't take the pig to market because it was in such a terrible state. But they eventually got it out of the cellar and put it back in the sty. And so that was another interesting thing that happened along the way.
So did that money that you earned doing the cottages start you off fee building at Road, or...? How did you manage to start up Road?
Well, I don't know why, but I seem to acquire money easily, you know. When I worked for this boilermaking firm, I worked all the hours God sent. And I couldn't spend any money. I couldn't spend any money because I was never anywhere to spend it. Carried on until I packed up and started on my own. And so I did have a sort of a reserve of money, but when you're paying out all the time to repair property, it soon runs away. So with the little jobs that I did, I did quite a bit of work for a Mr. Mead who ran New Dustin Post Office. Very, very nice man, and a wonderful man to work for. And he brought that shop from there were barely enough a trade to support one person. And he brought that along till he'd got it self-service, and he'd got seven assistants working. Well, it was incredible. And of course, the place was jam-packed everywhere with goods. The stairs was about a foot wide, and all the rest of it was stuff stacked up in the ceiling. I'd be called in frequently from time to time to go and do some emergency job, which he'd thought, you know, he used to think, oh, I could do so and so and so and so. So I'd go and do that, and then I'd get cash, you see, he always paid cash. And I'd have cash to finance my main project.
How was your house at the Elms going at
this point? I had once I'd finished the houses at New Dustin, I had to fall back on and start doing various works at Road. And what I did was I said to my wife, I decided by then that I'd got to have some help. And so I took Ray Moore on as an apprentice. And Ray was a very, very steady lad and very reliable and a very quick learner. And whereas a normal apprentice costs you money in the first year, Ray was earning money, and he was very, very good. That helped me quite a lot. But unfortunately, the people in Road then found out that I did jobbing work. And so I got saddled with no end of work. And I had a policy that I wouldn't turn work away. And I didn't question whether people were good payers or not either. Something you should do. But I just took everything that came our way, I just took it on.
How many people did you employ then?
Well, The next person I got was young David Richardson as an apprentice. Well, he was a natural with stone. He could do anything with stone. And then I had a chap, by this time we were getting the London overspill. And I had a very good, he was a plumbing and heating engineer, but he wanted to be an amateur boxer. So he didn't want to do plumbing and heating for me. He said he would do it, but he didn't want to do it. He wanted to be a labourer, so he built his muscles up. Mick Holly, he was a big, powerful lad. Very nice lad. So he worked as a labourer. And of course, when we got any plumbing and heating work, I used to switch him to that, but he insisted that he'd be allowed to do a bit of labouring on those days as well. Him and David used to go for runs early in the morning, as a bit of training. And then there was a lad at the garage who worked for Jack Reed. And well, he was supposed to be working for Jack Reed, and he wasn't any good at the garage. So we had this wonderful man at the Labour Exchange. Now, we can tell how long ago that is, can't you? Labour Exchange. But we had this wonderful manager at the Labour Exchange in Northampton. And he had somehow got to hear about Mr. Allen. So he said this boy was no good at the garage, but would I take him on temporarily as a labourer, because he didn't want him to be out of work. So I said, well, there was a lot of labouring work in building trade at that time, and I said, well, I will, but I said, it's difficult. My present setup, I haven't got enough of tradesmen. I said, I've got two apprentices who are very skilled lads, very, very skilled lads, but they're not men. So he said, well, would you be prepared to try some men? I said, well, if you just read the names out, I can tell you whether I will or not. But I said that most of the people who have come to the Labour Exchange, I said every builder in the county knows their names. And they all have a saying, no, I don't want him, no, I don't want him. And so, he said that from time to time I do get problems. I said, yes, I know. Well, I said, I've actually got one from Rhodes School. I said, a lad who drinks, smokes and swears, and he's beyond control. So I said, I've taken him on. No, I said, they say he smokes and drinks and swears. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing, he can't swear. He doesn't know how to swear. But I said, he does smoke, but I don't think he smokes excessively. I said, I'm not about the drinking, but we're going to find that out. And I was working at Jim Howard's at the time, and we'd done a conversion job on the downstairs, up in the loft, the wall stopped at wall plate level, and that triangle between the wall plate and the roof had got to be bricked up. So I'd had 4,000 bricks delivered, because in those days you did everything with bricks. I can't remember the lad's proper name, but they called him Smiler. And young David Richardson was doing the brickwork, although he didn't like it, but he was doing it. And these 4,000 bricks had to be carried up into these lofts, which was quite a tiring job. And so I said to David on the first day, oh, and this lad was a thief as well. He pinched a bottle of pop from out of Jim Howard's store. And I said, oh, you don't want to do things like that, boy. He said, you don't want to be the boy. Look, your age, I said, don't want to be drinking pop anyway. We'll go over to the pub at dinner time and have a pint of beer. He was supposed to be a drinker, you see. So I had a quiet word with David. And I said, now look, we'll go over to the Cock at lunchtime. And I said, I could do with a pint or two myself anyway. I said, I'll get a pint in for you, and I'll get a pint in for Smiler. Now I said, I know you don't like a lot of beer, especially in the middle of the day. So I said, if you just say cheers and start drinking in front of Smiler and get him drinking. And then I said, you can slide your glass along. There's always one or two barflies looking for a free drink. So slide your glass along and get somebody's empty. And then say to me, are we going to have another drink, boss, or are we going to make this do all dinner time? And I said, I'll make sure we get at least a couple of pints into Smiler, which we did very successfully. David thought it was a great idea. He enjoyed it immensely. We managed to get Smiler to drink two pints, and then he told me that he was not used to drinking a lot of beer like that, but he said he had enjoyed it. So then, of course, we went, had a bit of lunch and went back to work. And then when he started climbing this ladder with a hod of bricks on his shoulder, the calves of his legs began to go, you see. And when I went up there, he was leaned on a pile of bricks, and he immediately started scratching about as soon as I got up there. And he had been smoking, and the whole place was tinder dry, you see. And unfortunately, threw the cigarette down when he saw me coming. So I said to him, where did you throw that fag? What fag, he said. I said, I saw you smoking. And I said, you threw the fag down. I said, I don't mind you smoking. It had nothing to do with me, you were smoking. In fact, I said, if you want to smoke, I'll buy you a packet of fags. And David said, oh, I don't think you can manage a packet of fags. He said, he certainly can't manage 2 pints of beer. And teasing him, you see. And so I said, well, we're going to make sure that that's out, because it's a tailor-made cigarette, you know, smoulder on. And we did find it, and it was okay, actually. That was that. And then I said to him, now, look, you could smoke as much as you like, but for God's sake, don't throw the cigarette end down when you see me. I said, there's nothing wrong with smoking. I said, I smoked from the time I was 3. I smoked from the time I was 3 till I was 33. And so I said, it won't hurt you, really. But I wasn't bothered about him smoking.
No, no.
And all I was trying to do was teach him that, yeah, you know, there was more pleasure in life at behaving yourself than ever there was. And I never really got on to him except to lecture him about different things. And I remember saying to him, he did swear one day, I forget what had gone wrong, but he was swearing. And I said to him, look, if you are going to swear while I'm around, I said, at least you'll have to learn to swear properly. And I said, you don't know how to swear, not to be effective. And I said, well, really, the only thing you will become is foul-mouthed. I said, someone who is foul-mouthed uses swear words of different types all the time in conversation. But I said, a person who really swears knows how to swear effectively and for it to have an effect either on a human being or even on a horse. But I said, you have to start with sort of the milder words, and the words have to strengthen, and the delivery has to strengthen. And that's the all important thing I said. The swear words, the force of the swear words, and the force of the delivery, building up. And I said, I so happened to be very good at it, because I had proper training in the round timber trade. I said, I don't want you to learn to swear like I can. And you'd be best leaving it alone, because you're hopeless at it. So in the end, Smiler did more or less stop swearing. He certainly didn't use any strong language.
Did he stay with you for long?
He stayed, I think, about... He was booked into the army. In despair, they'd booked him into the army up here. And he stayed with me till he was ready to go in the army. It'll be something like probably 4 or 5 months, something like that. But he was, in our office, we'd got Muriel Maffitt. And she was a wonderful person, Muriel.
Muriel?
Muriel Maffitt.
Maffitt, oh.
She lived along Elizabeth Road. Her husband, Dave, was I think he was almost in charge of maintenance at the factory. Very clever chap. And of course, Muriel was trained as an office worker in an engineering workshop, where people are much more precise than in the building trade. And so it was taking her some effort to cope with the people in the building trade. But the one thing was that she could handle people, and most important of all, she could handle me. That was the most important discovery we made. And I promised Muriel I'd do different things. For instance, by this time, we were doing quite a lot of big jobs, and I'd got subcontractors working for me, and there was a lot of money going out in wages and things. And I decided that if I did the small cash jobs, it'd help with the wages flow, the cash flow rather. So originally I agreed with Muriel that when I got 10 small jobs lined up, I would pull men off other jobs and get those 10 jobs cleared up and start fresh. And then we would have small amounts of cash. And so that went on very well for a while. But then after some time it got to 20 jobs. And more pressure from Muriel. So I said, well then, all right, I'm in a bit of a fix, because everywhere where we're working, the client's breathing down my neck. And I had great difficulty in pulling people off to do this work. But I said, all right, I'll do quite a lot myself, and I'll pull a bloke off here and another one off there, and we'll get it done. So we never did quite clear the 20, but we whittled it down to 4 or 5. And I remember that ultimately it got to, when you get to 40 small jobs, you've got to stop doing them. But as I say, she really could handle me, and she really got results. So and she also...
By this time you had an office in your barn, did you?
No, we had the front, what was officially the front room, was made into an office, and indeed you can still see today where we had the sliding window in the side wall. I put a sliding window in there, where the bloke stopped on the roadway and picked up their tickets and that from this window. And then, if you remember, the yard entrance was by the house, and it was a very sharp curve there to get up into the yard. But
Was it a do-it-yourself at this point?
Ah, well, I'll come to that in a second, if I may. I was just going to tell you about Muriel and her book. Muriel was very intrigued by the phone calls that she got. And so she kept a book. I mean, you, as a builder, you have a day book where everything's recorded. But in addition to that, Muriel had this phone book for herself, which included all these weird messages. And they were wonderful. And in fact, a few years ago, it's only perhaps 3 or 4 years ago, I saw a couple standing at the end of my drive and looking up the drive, and I was sorting some firewood out. And I looked down the drive and saw these two people, and I thought, I recognised the chap. I haven't seen him for a long time, but I recognised him. So they were someone I'd done work for around road area. And when they came to pay their bill, Muriel was reading out one of her comical phone messages to someone else. And the woman was so intrigued that she said, well, she saw that Muriel had got a lot of messages written down, and she said, well, are they all funny messages? So Muriel said, yes. Yes, because she said, you get some, people say some very funny things. Yes, she said, I've written them down. Unfortunately, she took the book with her, which was, you know, her right to have the book. But there are a couple of messages that I always remember, and one was a lady in this village who I'm not going to mention her name, but she was always rather frantic, shall we say. She built herself up and she got a bit desperate. So anyway, she rang up one day about 12 o'clock, midday, and she said, is Mr. Allen there? So Muriel said, no, what did you want? Oh, she said, I must have Mr. Allen. Well, of course, everybody wants the gaffer, so... And Muriel and Kathleen were in the office as well, of course, and they both knew this. So Muriel said, well, he's not here at the moment. He's not around the yard or anything. But he has promised to come back at lunchtime and sign some papers. So he will come sometime during the lunch hour. Of course, if you're frantic somewhere, that's not a lot of help, is it, really? And so she said, well, what time is lunch hour? So Muriel said, from 12:30 till 1 o'clock. So she said, well, that's not an hour. Well, she said, he doesn't have an hour. But that's his lunchtime, 12:30 to 1 o'clock. And we know that sometime between 12:30 and 1 o'clock, he'll be here to sign these papers. And so, she said, well, you'll have to ring again about 12:30 if he's not here. But as soon as he does come, we'll send him up. So, anyway, she rang again within a quarter of an hour, you know. And Kathleen said to Muriel, well, because Muriel always took the phone call, she said, ask him what trade it is, because we've got several blokes working in the village and near to the village. So Muriel said, well, we have several people, several tradesmen of different trades working in and around the village. So she said, what trade is it? So the woman said, well, she said, no, it's no good having a tradesman, she said, because they won't know what to do. only Mr. Allen will know what to do. He's handled his trouble before, and he knows exactly what to do, and he can deal with it very quickly. But she said, I don't think ordinary workmen could do it. So Kathleen took over the phone then, and she said, yeah, I know, but everybody wants the boss, and the boss can't do everything. Are you sure that somebody else couldn't do it? Oh, yes, she said, I'm positive. So, anyway, it just turned 12:30. She rang again. And of course, Kathleen could deal with a lot of things herself. And so she said, look, would you please tell us what exactly is wrong? And we'll decide who can cope with it. So this woman said, well, she said, I'm in terrible trouble. And so Kathleen said, yes, and what is the trouble? She said, well, my drawers are stuck and my husband's things in them. What actually happened was she had an Elizabeth Ann all-steel unit, a five-drawer unit. And if you dropped a knife, the cutlery was obviously in the top drawer, and if you dropped a knife in particular, but a fork or spoon would do it, if that dropped down the back, it locked all the drawers, and you couldn't get a single drawer open. And her husband suffered from asthma, and they always kept his puffer in the top drawer of the sink. And of course, she couldn't get it out. So the fact that her drawers were stuck and her husband's thing was in it, there was a good explanation. But when you ring an office and say things like that, it can be a bit confusing. And Muriel had quite a list of these sort of things. And I remember another one where a woman from New Dustin, I had, as I say, done a lot of work in New Dustin, so I was well known. And, this oldish woman rang up, and she lived in an end of terrace house. And the overflow from her toilet was overflowing. And it was winter time. And in the late afternoon, of course, the passageway through started to freeze. And with this ice, it was very dangerous. And naturally, she was very worried. And I was working somewhere. You've got to bear in mind the telephone weren't as good in those days as they are now. I was working somewhere where they had a telephone, and I'd given the number in at the office. And they'd rung me and told me about this woman, and I said, well, I'd try to be there by 2:00. And so she rang the office at 2:00, and she said that she'd been waiting since about 12:00, hoping Mr. Allen would come. But he promised to be there at 2:00. And she said, and he still hadn't come at 2:00, she said. And my doings is dribbling all over the place. So well, that was another amusing thing. And
how long did she stay with him, Muriel? Did she stay long?
Quite a while. Yeah, she stayed, in fact, until they moved. Well, just before they moved into Northampton, and I think her and her husband moved to Wales and kept a B&B.
And did Pauline come to work for you
then? Yes. Pauline and we also had Belinda from Hartwell. Belinda Walton. She was very efficient. No matter what happened, Belinda stayed calm, you know.